Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, M.D. Perkins, on Christian activism and protesting immorality in the culture.
People ask, well, was any of this activism effective? Well, I can go walk into my local grocery store now and not see pornographic magazines. That wasn't an accident. That was because there was concerted effort by Christians two or three decades ago that actually raised a stink about this, got these corporations to stop selling those magazines, and they've never picked it back up again. So that's a piece of the lasting legacy of Don Wildman and his impact.
M.D. Perkins, next. While some say fighting immorality in the culture is a losing proposition, M.D. Perkins of the American Family Association begs to differ. He's the director of the new documentary, Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency. Wildman was the founder of the AFA, and M.D. Perkins is with us to talk about his legacy.
Would you tell us a little bit about the organization?
The American Family Association goes all the way back to 1977. A United Methodist minister named Donald Wildman was concerned about television and started something called the National Federation for Decency, which was basically a citizens' awareness group talking about the influence of media, the negative representations in media of Christians, as well as just the raunchy content that was on TV, which we're talking about the 70s and 80s. We're talking about only the three main networks, you know. But from that point on, the organization grew, started confronting other culture war issues, such as the issues of pornography, the homosexual agenda, corporate responsibility, and a number of these different things, religious liberty, and all these sorts of other issues that we've added to things that we focus on over the years. Of course, American Family Association also added a radio network in the early 1990s. And so American Family Radio is something that people may be familiar with in certain parts of the country. We have about 180 radio stations nationwide that carries original content and commentary on cultural issues, political engagement, connecting the Christian worldview really to all aspects of society, politics, and just everyday Christian living. So there's some preaching content on there, obviously, as well as up-to-date on the current events and issues that are happening that are shaping our nation. That's kind of the big picture of AFA. I'm a piece of this larger thing. This isn't my ministry. I just work here, you know. I'm in our American Family Studios department. We do all the video work, creating documentaries, curriculum, and all kinds of different media content to just highlight these issues from different perspectives, maybe reaching different audiences with them, and just continuing the work from this perspective.
What brought you to the AFA?
So I went to film school. I went to Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, Georgia, studied film and television production. I grew up in Tupelo. The ministry's based in Tupelo, Mississippi. And so ended up back in my hometown, not to get a job here, just because providentially a lot of things dried up in other places where we were. So my wife and I headed back home. And then ended up having a couple of friends from church who were working for the ministry, was able to get me in. And we were beginning work on some of the early documentaries that they were starting to pick up with this department. My area of expertise corresponded well with a need that they had. And so I've been here since 2014, just writing, producing, directing these documentaries, and also getting into some of this this research, which was an extension of the documentary work, because you do so much research on the front end of a documentary. So the research fellow of church and culture was just kind of a way to describe and encapsulate that aspect of my work as well.
Yeah, you wrote this documentary, or you directed it, I should say, to be more accurate, Culture Warrior, about your founder, Don Wildman. I guess since that's an early part of your, or at least the organization's history, it seems like a good place to start talking about Christianophobia. You mentioned in the first question that some of the networks in the 70s and 80s portrayed Christians in a poor light. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, this was something that Don latched onto pretty early on. So in 1977, when he starts the ministry, of course, it's mostly highlighting sex and violence on television. But then as he's starting to do this research, what he started was a television monitoring program where he had volunteers nationwide who were watching primetime television, filling out these survey forms that the NFD was putting together, early days of AFA, so that it would actually chart what were the depictions that were happening on these certain shows, so that you could actually put on a graph and quantify how much sex, how much violence, how much profanity was in each of these different programs. And so then you could quantify that. You could also start to compile it by network, which networks were the most responsible for this. But also a clever thing that he was doing was to cite what were the advertisers that were sponsoring each of these shows. Because back in those days, whatever TV commercials played, those were the sponsors for that particular program. The only way to know that information was to actually watch the show. There wasn't some place you could go to actually get a list of these advertisers. So to actually watch these programs, make a list of those shows, and then to begin these boycott campaigns against some of the most notorious either shows or sponsors of these shows. So that was the early days of activism of AFA. And what Don began to realize rather quickly is that even if you removed sex and violence from television, there was still something wrong with it. And that was the worldview underneath it and the ideologies that were at play among the network elites, a lot of the producers and writers of these shows, the executive producers. All of these people seemed to have a similar secular vision of the world. And it completely excluded Christians. You know, Don kind of made the point at one point in time, if the nation is, you know, at least 50% would say that they're religious or religiously active or attend church, and really the ratio at that point was probably higher than that. But why aren't we seeing more depictions of Christians in just everyday life on these television shows? You know, you never run across a Christian on TV at this point, unless it was an older show like Little House on the Prairie, where it was a simpler time and there was a country preacher or a parson or somebody that was just part of the story. But in a TV show set in the modern day, you never ran across a Christian unless he was judgmental, hypocritical, doing something he shouldn't be doing, you know, and all these different things. And so he began to realize that this is actually shaped by people in controlling the way that the Christian representation is going out, and also trying to discourage the representation of Christians in these media platforms. And also that was shaping the way that news was beginning to depict things too. Less stories about religious involvement and things like that were growing throughout the 80s and 90s. You know, you go back to the 1920s and things that would happen at the general assemblies or general conferences of denominations, that was covered in the New York Times. But that began to happen less and less, unless it was a particularly controversial issue like gay ordination or something that would pick up the headlines. But just the normal course of here's what the denomination is discussing. So all of these things shifted throughout the 20th century from a culture that understood or appreciated aspects of Christianity to one that wasn't just neutral, but was becoming more hostile overall.
You know, I just had an interview like not too long ago, like about the Scopes trial, considering we're celebrating the 100 years from then. You know, the idea that we kind of talked a little bit about is that it was the Scopes trial when people started seeing Christians as, like you mentioned, you know, judgmental, fundamentalistic, anti-science, anti-reason, all of this sort of thing. Do you think there's a connection there between the Scopes trial and how the networks started portraying Christians?
Yeah, I do, because I don't know much about the Scopes trial, but that whole era of the early part of the 20th century, from really the 1890s up through about 1930, 1940, this was an extreme period of shifting in the nation, and part of the major secularization of American society that kind of happened unawares to most Christians, I think, and the rise of the fundamentalist movement, which was a reaction to the decline of the mainline denominations, where, you know, you had like the Presbyterian Church, suddenly it becomes increasingly liberal in its theology, also starting to embrace aspects of the social gospel. And so two things that kind of happen at that point, Christians begin to step away from some of the social activity because they're fearful that it corresponds too much with the social gospel. And the liberal elites just kind of take over all these institutions But while they're carrying the moniker of Christian, they're basically setting the pace for how Christianity is going to be defined in American society. And I don't think we really understood that until almost a century later, of like, why do you go on CNN and they want to talk to some Christian? And it's always some guy who's questioning, you know, the validity of the Bible. Did miracles really happen? You know, all these sorts of things that are theological questions. But then, of course, that's the image. The religious left ended up winning the day without the religious right even waking up until kind of the mid to late 1970s.
And so I guess that kind of sets the stage for, culture, I guess, defining Christianity for us. So would you tell us a little bit about Don Wildman's story? Yeah, you mentioned he started monitoring these networks and looks like he had some pushback.
Don was a firebrand. He was definitely a country preacher and he carried that persona, but also the way that people misunderstood him because of that background and because of the country draw and his accent and all of these things. Like, for example, in 1981, he engaged in a debate with one of the vice presidents of CBS about his boycott campaigns. And the vice president of CBS basically says that Christians shouldn't do this sort of thing. But the way that Don understood what he was saying is he was saying, like, well, you have the right to do it, but you shouldn't do it as a Christian because somehow that is becoming totalitarian or authoritarian or, you know, is moving toward this theocracy. And so all of these ideas, you know, we still get lobbed with these same sorts of, you know, accusations today. But all of those things were very present there in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when Don was active in this kind of work. When he took on the pornographers, part of what he focused on very cleverly was to go after Playboy and Penthouse, these softcore magazines that were being sold in convenience stores, because he realized that the biggest distributor of pornography in the country was actually 7-Eleven. It wasn't these other outfits. It wasn't these little mom and pop places. When you're selling that much pornography, how are you really regulating that? Are you really keeping that out of the sight lines of children and out of the hands of children? And there's just so many ways that children could still access it. And so he began to go after 7-Eleven and the Southland Corporation, who owned 7-Eleven. And so that was a big campaign in the middle of the 1980s. And Southland was very resistant throughout a long stretch of that. But through Don's influence and a lot of other Christian groups began to get involved in this. James Dobson had a film series that was going around and being shown to try and get Christians activated on this issue, because Christians were very hesitant to get involved. One, because they hadn't really seen pornography, but two, they weren't clear that this was even that big of a threat or a problem. That initial education hurdle, and that's been a major part of AFA's activism throughout these decades, is to try and equip and inform Christians about the issues so that then they can respond in action and activism and getting involved and being able to speak out on these things with information and with confidence. You know, that's the story of Culture Warrior. You know, it is about Don and this particular ministry. But really, if you're a Christian and you wonder, how did we get here as a society? Go watch this movie, because I think you'll be shocked, actually, at some of the discussions that were happening 30 or 40 years ago. All of these different movements and things that were already at play in smaller form. You know, some of these battles are ongoing and have changed now. You know, the way that we fight pornography now isn't going after the convenience store selling the magazines. But at the same time, you know, people ask, well, was any of this activism effective? Well, I can go walk into my local grocery store now and not see pornographic magazines. That wasn't an accident. That was because there was concerted effort by Christians two or three decades ago that actually raised a stink about this, got these corporations to stop selling those magazines, and they've never picked it back up again. So that's a piece of the lasting legacy of Don Wildman and his impact. You know, Don used to be one of those names of major Christian speakers that was well known in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. He was considered one of the most feared men in Hollywood because of his power to get people activated with their boycott efforts. His biography is called The Man the Networks Love to Hate. That was the book that he, his autobiography, because he knew that they knew his name, even if the average American didn't always know the name Don Wildman. But they knew that if Don was raising the flag about something and pointing out an issue, they better watch out, because there may actually be enough of a response that they better better be geared up and ready for it.
Could you tell us a little bit more about changes that have come about in our culture because of Don Wildman's ministry that maybe we take for granted?
Part of the rise of Christian activism is really connected with Don. A strategic focus among Christians to not just think about, well, I'm just going to elect this public official and then hope that things work out well. I can get involved in specific letter writing or phone call campaigns. I can, the power of the public protest and using that at specific points, using boycotts to try and raise awareness about an issue, not just, you know, here's a confusing thing that people don't realize about boycotts. It's not always just about getting the response from the company that you're trying to get. Sometimes just the power of the public witness actually discourages other companies from following that direction. And it gives you an opportunity and a platform to talk about the issues that you want to get into the media and into people's public conversation. In 1977, the first campaign Don did was something called Turn the Television Off Week. And this was just something he was doing with his local church. He did write a press release and send it to the local newspapers, not really expecting a whole lot besides maybe a little, you know, local interest column or something. But suddenly that gets picked up by the Associated Press, and hundreds of newspapers are now writing about the Turn the Television Off Week. And suddenly what happens there in the late 1970s is there's a public discussion happening that goes well beyond Don Wildman about the impact of television on our society and the impact on children, and how much TV are children watching? How many violent killings are they going to see over the course of their life if they're watching this much television? And discussions about how sexuality might be influenced by things that people are watching on television. All of these different things are happening because the power of one man standing up and speaking out about it. And so that's really kind of the message behind Culture Warrior, which, by the way, you can go watch for free at culturewarrior.movie. You can go watch it on the website, culturewarrior.movie. That's the story. One person actually can make a difference. And I think that's something that Christians right now need to realize, that the battle seems so big. They seem so much bigger than us. People involved in seem so much smarter than us, and all of these different things. But if you take these little simple acts of faithfulness, the Lord can actually exponentially grow that beyond what you could ask or imagine. And what Don always said was that God hasn't called us to be successful. He's called us to be faithful. And if we're faithful, the success of this effort is in the Lord's hands. Whatever God wants to do with that, it is His to choose what He might want to do with that. But we can control our own faithfulness. We can control our response to this issue. And if we're faithful, then we know that that is something that the Lord could bless. But if we're not faithful, then why would we expect the Lord to bless it? You know, and if we're cutting corners or not doing things in the right way, we're not being honest about it, why would we expect the Lord's blessing on it? So that integrity, that sense of purpose, that act of faith, all of those things I think are really inspiring about the story of Don. And so I hope people really do take advantage of that opportunity to go watch the movie at culturewarrior.movie, because it does tell our own recent history in a way that I think people will find compelling. I mean, this isn't a slow-moving documentary. I mean, we've got almost 50 years of history to go through to cover the spectrum from Don starting this in 77 to his retirement in 2009 and dealing with the marriage battles in the early 2000s. He gets sued by Playboy and Penthouse because of all the stuff he's raising up with them. You know, he shines a spotlight on the National Endowment for the Arts and this government funding that's going to fund pornographic and blasphemous artwork in the late 80s, early 90s, the Last Temptation of Christ movie, and the way that Christians nationwide got energized about the way that a Hollywood movie was treating Jesus on the screen in such a negative portrayal. And all of these different stories are there in the movie Culture Warrior. So go watch it at culturewarrior.movie.
I guess looking a little more to the culture as it stands now today, you mentioned Don Wildman's legacy is one of being faithful. It is, to a degree, more contentious argument among Christians about, like, to what extent are we responsible for what happens in this world, knowing that our real citizenship is with God in the new heavens and the new earth. So my question to you, I guess, is what does faithfulness look like? Keeping our eyes set on our real citizenship in heaven and, you know, maybe not getting too, being too concerned with seeing success here in this world.
Well, that's always a delicate balance as Christians. But I think the big picture, scripturally, what does it mean to be culturally engaged? You know, one of those key passages is the passage about being salt and light. That idea that the salt is preserving and holding back the rot. So the rot is inevitable. There's aspects in which things will always be corrupting, and we can't utterly eradicate that until the Lord returns and redeems all things and everything is made perfect again, right? So, like, that is something, but we're still called to preserve. And we preserve by our existence as Christians, and we preserve through our faithfulness to that calling and the faithfulness that we have to the truth of the scripture. I think that's something that we need to latch onto as Christians. Like, that in one sense, if you're living as a Christian, whether or not you're culturally involved, you're still active in the work of holding back the darkness in some aspect of society. Whether it's just you're dealing with an individual here, or you're having a conversation with your neighbor, or you're raising up your children to think rightly about the world, all of those things are, in a way, actually activist activities, because they're constructive, they're discipleship, they're pointing people toward Christ, they're building things up, they're pointing people toward the truth. But if you're talking about being active in kind of the second level of direct action in society, I mean, that is something that Christians should be involved in, because one, in America, like, we have the right and the opportunity, and with that freedom is the responsibility to be active and participate in it. And that was one of the frustrating things that Don found when he was combating this with the networks, was almost like Christians had abdicated their responsibility in this, you know, several decades ago, and therefore that status quo needed to continue, was the expectation, that Christians just needed to stay on the sidelines and just let the secularists and the liberals handle it. That really wasn't Don's approach at all, and that more and more Christians were beginning to wake up to the state of the nation, just how quickly things declined in that span from, you know, the early 1920s to 1977. There's all of these illustrations that are out there that show us that being active matters. Your participation matters. Even just the public witness matters, because when you stand up and you speak for the truth, you actually have the opportunity for others to respond to the truth instead of just keeping it to yourself. Don would say this when he was dealing with pornography in the convenience stores, which is, you could decide personally, I'm not going to shop here anymore. Great. You've made a personal convicted decision to not do something. But if you don't tell anybody, if you don't write a letter to the store manager or have a phone call with him, then he has actually no opportunity to respond to your conviction and to recognize the reality of what he's doing. Now, he may not respond favorably to that, but he just might. What he found over and over again was that basically we were just leaving money on the table, so to speak, in these situations, because he said that there were so many managers that were actually very responsive to what citizens wanted, but they needed the complaint of an average person. They couldn't make their own decision. They had to receive a complaint in order to remove the magazines. Just that principle, I think, is really helpful for us when we think about the power of public witness, because it gives people the opportunity to respond. And it also gives us the opportunity to present Christ. And sometimes it also gives us that additional evangelistic opportunity, which sometimes comes in these situations, where even if you're locking arms with people who are agreed on this particular social issue, you can make the connection to why I'm doing it is based on a conviction that's founded in scripture. And here's what Jesus has done for me. And then maybe you can point somebody to the light of the gospel in that situation too. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why we could get behind that, but that salt and light, that's kind of the core biblical backing for a lot of what we do as a ministry.
It does seem like maybe Christians, especially in some Protestant circles, unfortunately. Yeah, maybe lack that backbone. We just like to be nice. And so we don't like to make a fuss and complain about maybe, you know, seeing, you know, certain content on the racks in our local grocery store or something like that. How can the gospel inspire our hearts with courage to step up and actually say something and do something about it?
Well, I remember there's a passage in the book of Acts in chapter 4. It says, "And now, Lord, this is the prayer of the apostles." So they're in the midst of facing persecution because of Christ. And they say, "And now, Lord, look upon their threats and grant to your servants to continue to speak your word with all boldness." So, like, they're praying for boldness. It's not just us stirring ourselves up in our own strength. We have to be dependent on the Lord in this too. But also just the heart of that prayer, like when faced with persecution and resistance, their prayer isn't remove the persecution and the resistance. The prayer is just make us stronger, give us more courage, help us to stand more firmly, help me to be able to articulate this more clearly so that I don't mess this up by failing in my own weakness in this situation. Just help me to stand firm. And so I think that's what I would encourage Christians with is we have what we need. The Lord is gracious and merciful. He gives us grace upon grace. If we just reach out to him and ask him for what we need in that situation, I have confidence that he'll provide that. That's the faith of living like a Christian in these situations. Yes, you know, when you're sitting back and it's and things are a little bit comfortable, it's hard to want to place yourself in a position where you're going to have these confrontational situations or conversations or arguments or public witness or whatever. But the reality is we already live in a spiritual war. You can't avoid the reality of that. And so we're just saying, like, step out into it with confident hope, praying that the Lord would give you what you need and trusting that he will give that as you step out in faith.
You use this term of Christianophobia, which, you know, in our culture at large is, you define it, I think, as just the irrational hatred of Christians. We've talked a lot about maybe how to engage against that in our culture. I can't help but think, though, that a lot of our listeners are going to be coming from more rural areas of the United States, like Montana, Wyoming, which tend to be more churched, I think. For those that don't have to engage in a day-to-day battle with Christianophobes, shall we say, how can they be aware of maybe cultural blind spots that might creep in to their local community?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I live in Northeast Mississippi, you know, so like part of my day-to-day world is full of a lot of people that seem to share similar values as me. But then again, that's not really true once you start having some of these conversations and even people in my own church or people I grew up with, people are susceptible to all kinds of ideologies. So I think part of it is just maintaining that recognition to not get discouraged by that. But to also, if you're in a place where maybe you have a little more liberty or you feel like you're not in this sense of conflict, to really recognize the unique position that you're in, to take some ground there, because there's still ways that people aren't thinking rightly or clearly about certain things. There's still ways that people needed to be pointed to more conformity in Christ, or there's also ways that people are just kind of nominally have agreed with the status quo religion of the area, but haven't really committed themselves to the Lord. And so there's still ample opportunities to serve Christ and to speak a word in season, even in a situation like that, that in one sense doesn't seem as hostile as a place like New York or Los Angeles, but at the same time, there's still opposition fundamentally in the human heart to God, and there's still ways that all of us need to be conformed more to what the scripture teaches. There's still a lot of opportunities there, and maybe if it's easier in a certain sense, then you'll feel more liberty to have those conversations. And don't lose that time, because the reality is we're not guaranteed that these things will last forever. You know, I mean, even the voting demographics of the nation are shifting right now, and people are moving from some of these blue states to red states. And over the next 20 years, that could actually significantly change the voting habits within those states. So don't just assume that, well, I live in this state and we have always voted this way, and so things will be safe, you know, throughout my children's life. No, just really take advantage of the time that you have where maybe there's some wind in your sails as you move through things. So I would just kind of point people in that in that way. Hopefully that makes sense and that's helpful.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, M.D. Perkins of the American Family Association. He's the director of the new documentary, Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency. You can watch it for free at culturewarrior.movie. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at the same time for another edition of His People.